This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. This week and next week, we're dedicating the whole program to the Black Agenda Report Team's activities at the Left Forum in New York City. The Left Forum is the nation's biggest yearly gathering of left-wing activists. The Black Agenda Report panel is always well attended. You'll hear presentations by bar editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly, contributing political analyst Danny Haifong, and Haitian community activist Daoud André. We'll also bring you my presentation to the opening plenary session of Left Forum. Next week, we'll have presentations by Bar Managing Editor Bruce Dixon, Bar Editor and columnist Ajamu Baraka, who ran for Vice President on the Green Party ticket last year, and from Dr. Anthony Monteiro, the Du Boisian scholar and a longtime comrade of Bar. Black Agenda Radio's Nellie Bailey was host for the panel discussion.
We're going to start with Senior Editor Margaret Kimberly, whose weekly column, Freedom Rider, has garnered national and international attention. She is a New York-based writer and an activist for peace and justice issues. Margaret is on the steering committee of the United National Anti-War Coalition. She has been a columnist for Black Agenda Report since its inception and was for 4 years the weekly columnist for Black Commentator.
We've heard a lot about resistance ever since the night of November 8th, which was Election Day. That day, Donald Trump upended the political world with the upset of Hillary Clinton. She had the backing of corporate media, nearly all Democratic Party elected officials, and even of some Republicans who decided to live with her because they thought Trump was going to lose. She raised $1 billion in her campaign effort, and that alone is proof of support from most of the ruling class, or 1%. I admit I didn't see this coming either, but once it happened, I've been on point with one theme. That night, I wrote a column called Dumping the Democrats for Good. That is the only way to resist Trump. In retrospect, I believe that Donald Trump won enough votes for an electoral college victory when he announced he was going to build a wall on the border with Mexico. He went straight to the heart of the matter for many white Americans. It turns out they didn't care as much about Republican Party orthodoxy as we were led to believe. They didn't care about tax cuts for the rich or wars of aggression. They wanted a country where they were clearly on top, that is to say, made great again. They wanted, and one can't argue against it, the return of a day when they could depend on living wage jobs. Of course, making America great again is dangerous to many other people. A few days ago, I saw a video on social media about an undocumented Latino man, I think in Florida. Anyway, this man was riding a bike, and he was hit by a car. So he's lying in the street, injured. The police come. Instead of calling an ambulance, they start asking him, "Are you legal?" Unfortunately, he was undocumented and was deported because he got hit by a car. And this is just one example of what has been unleashed in the Trump victory. But this is where things also get a little tricky. As we pointed out in the Black Agenda Report last week, Obama also ramped up deportations and can be truly called the deporter-in-chief. It's true the new attorney general is open about maintaining mass incarceration, but Obama didn't do anything to dismantle that system either. So, but despite the doom and the gloom, we have an opportunity with the Trump victory. The trap of black people within the confines of the Democratic Party always brings us disaster. I recall the near euphoria when Bill Clinton was elected after three successive Republican victories. But what did we get? Welfare so-called reform, which impoverished millions of people, mass incarcerations, and the beginning of Wall Street being given a free hand to create a bubble which decimated black people financially. Obama came into office, swept into victory. Did he overturn any of those policies or George W. Bush's policies? Obamacare, the one thing that's always shoved in our faces, if you ever question Obama, but Obamacare. It was a Republican plan, bailed out the health insurance and big pharma industries, which are the cause of all our health care woes. He made it clear that the people who loved him most were not going to get any consideration from him. We got a lot of scolding, but that was all. Wars of aggression against nations we used to support, and nothing else but a black face in the high place. But the Democrats were on shaky ground. The Obama team's marketing got him into office and covered a multitude of sins. But since that time, since 2008, the Democrats have lost the House, the Senate, control of most states. Their fundraising goes almost entirely to presidential campaigns. They don't even go through the motions of fighting Republicans for control of state legislatures. And Republicans then drew district lines, which created more safe seats than the House for them. So the Democrats don't care if abortion rights are taken away. They don't care about voter ID laws and voter suppression, which steal votes from black people. Hillary Clinton probably lost the key states of Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania because of voter suppression, but she has said nothing about it until a couple of days ago. And the rest of the Democrats are equally silent. Around the Inauguration Day, Congressman John Lewis was asked if he thought Trump was a legitimate president, and he said no. Did he say he was illegitimate because of the Electoral College? No. Did he say he was illegitimate because he owed his victory to black voter suppression? No. Mr. Civil Rights Icon said that Trump was illegitimate because of Russia. Russia, 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 which is all they can muster to hide their failure and keep the war party in business. It must be clearly stated as often as possible that the Democrats are to blame for Trump's victory. They know how to get votes. All they have to do is give people what they want. Minimum wage increase, living wage jobs, an end to the $1 trillion college debt industry, Medicare for all. But they don't offer any of these policies because the people who give them money don't want it to happen, and they don't want to bite the hands that feed them. So now they're using Trump as a punching bag and fundraising poster child. I don't think they really want to impeach him because Vice President Pence is seen as being less dangerous and won't keep frightened voters in line with the Democrats who keep failing them. What have they done since Election Day? They have refused to even give the appearance that they are willing to push for even meager reforms. Look at the race for the DNC chairmanship. Keith Ellison is not as progressive as advertised. Yes, he endorsed Bernie Sanders, but that's about all. So instead of letting him win the seat and give the appearance of giving something to Sanders supporters, they instead recruit Tom Perez to keep selling what voters aren't buying, to make it clear that the Democratic Party is not changing anything. As Nancy Pelosi said, we don't need to change anything. I don't know if anybody else saw that. But anyway, at this point in the conversation, we always hear about lesser evilism and that Republicans are so terrible and third parties are just spoilers. But I say, first of all, the Democrats can't even win anything anymore, so they can't even give you a semblance of lesser evilism. So we have to talk about replacing them and having a true workers' party, true peace party. So let's put the Democrats out of their misery. Let's pull the plug and get them out of our lives. But that will require serious resistance against them first and not Trump first. But this is going to be hard because it's been a long time since we had a mass movement, and that's what really brings about change and resistance. You know, these debates aren't really new. In the 60s, there were debates about should Lyndon Johnson be confronted because he'd been so good to black people? Can you criticize Dr. King because he's done so much? And there were debates, but there was always someone who said, hell yes, we can confront them. People didn't just shut up and go home. They actually did it because liberation was the goal. 50 years later, we've gone backwards and we rely on discredited policies instead of our own power to liberate ourselves. I was struck after Election Day that there was so little anger directed at the Democrats. Trump, being Trump, is a target. And he's a hard target to ignore. I know that. But you know, he's always doing something. He's tweeting something crazy or pushes the president of Montenegro or doesn't know who Frederick Douglass is or puts his dumb son-in-law in charge of foreign policy. There's always something to pay attention to, but that should not fool us. And lastly, I touched briefly on the Congressional Black Caucus when I mentioned John Lewis, but he's not alone. They're the worst hacks in the Democratic Party. They take their cues straight from Democratic Party leadership. They don't even talk about black people anymore. If they're not talking about Russia, they're not talking about anything. So they have to be resisted first. They're the gatekeepers, these misleaders, and we've got to get rid of them. You know, I'm not going to say that Trump is not bad for black people, not bad for the country. So all of the things I mentioned are true, but they're not the worst thing affecting our lives. Police murder, incarceration, unemployment are all worse, and they weren't being addressed before he became president. So it's not really a difference for us or those people who are getting the worst treatment in the country. So resisting the Democrats first is essential because they brought all these calamities into our lives, and there's no reason to believe that they will be any different. Thank you very much.
Danny Haifong is a Black Agenda columnist, and he is also an Asian activist and political analyst in the Boston area. His recent article, 10 Examples of How U.S. Imperialism Continues to Kill the People and Planet, noted, quote, "What has been called a race to the bottom by some scholars is really a permanent crisis in the system as a whole." And so I bring to you Danny Haifong.
When I was here last year, I spoke a lot about ideology and how the struggle for social transformation in the mainland of imperialism partly depended upon the ideological development of oppressed people trapped within U.S. borders. The 2016 elections were beginning to pick up momentum, but it was unclear what direction they would go. Fast forward to the present, and I don't know about you all, but I'm exhausted. The election of Donald Trump has presented both old and new challenges. It has created an almost circus-like political environment with dire consequences for the masses. What precipitated the circus show is a crisis of governance that has been intentionally misunderstood by U.S. imperialism's corporately owned media and political elite. To distort the crisis, a state of anti-Russian madness has been prescribed to medicate political consciousness in rapidly changing times. The rise of China in Russia has exposed the bankruptcy of U.S. imperialism on all fronts. Economic crisis at home and endless war abroad has placed finance and monopoly capital in political disarray. Now, Donald Trump took advantage of the chaos. He spoke about jobs, he spoke about wars, and he spoke to the growing insecurities of white Americans of working and middle class status who no longer can rely on the wages of whiteness for guaranteed prosperity. The duopoly and its capitalist masters had no one to offer, indeed nothing to offer. So Trump rode in on his orange horse to become the head of state of imperialism. The ruling class do not want people in the United States to understand the context of the Trump presidency. It has reapplied Cold War fears with Russia as the prime target. Russia's geopolitical moves away from imperialism have been deemed just as criminal as China's economic supremacy. The U.S. does not depend as much on Russia in the economic sense, but it trembles in fear at the prospect of growing Russian economic activity across Eurasia. Yet provoking Russia militarily will lead to world war, and this is a risk the ruling class appears willing to take. The anti-Russian narrative in the U.S. has only intensified since Hillary Clinton made the erroneous claim of Russian interference in the 2016 elections over a year ago. According to the U.S. ruling class and its intelligence officials, Russia promotes fake news to assist Donald Trump. Russian President Vladimir Putin is lurking in our social media and hacking his way through algorithms to smear the U.S. political system. Russia is infecting minds with its Russia Today propaganda arm. The Ruskies have no regard for the damage they have caused to so-called U.S. democracy. Putin wants total control of the United States and will wield his most talented social media users to get the job done. This is what the corporate media sounds like these days. Of course, the U.S. ruling class does not want to talk about how U.S. intelligence already collects the numbers, the emails, and the calls of every single person in the world who uses a cell phone or a computer. They don't want to tell you about how the U.S. has interfered in every election in Russia since the Soviet Union fell, or how it has led bloody proxy wars and coups in over 50 countries in as many years. They don't want to discuss how Russia has absolutely nothing to do with the millions of incarcerated people in the U.S., or the fact that it is the U.S. monopoly capitalist economy, not the emerging capitalist economy of Russia, which has automated many of the jobs and siphoned much of the wealth that once belonged to a privileged sector of U.S. workers. No, it would rather attention be placed on the Russian boogeyman. Anti-Russian hysteria doesn't just distract the broad masses of people from the legitimate causes of the conditions afflicting the working and unemployed. It feeds into an atmosphere of war that strikes the very roots of the U.S. social order. Imperialism is the rule of monopoly and finance capital. This system has run its course. It cannot hold on to political legitimacy any more than it can spur economic development beyond the meager 1% to 2% growth calculated year after year. In a sense, war is all the system has left. And war is exactly what the ruling class will get with or without Trump. War with Russia is today's clarion call for, quote, American unity. In times of crisis, the U.S. imperial state has relied on war to bring about political and economic relief from domestic crisis. Every major U.S.-led war has in part been waged for this purpose. What differs now is that war with Russia could bring about the destruction of humanity. Scientists have confirmed that nuclear war could make the planet uninhabitable. What is also different about this current war drive with Russia is how it marks the historical conclusion of the current stage in the world imperialist order as a whole. When the U.S. threatened nuclear war with the atomic bombing of Japan in 1945 and the Cuban Missile Crisis almost two decades later, the world was in the midst of a transition from Western monopoly capitalism to proletarian socialism. Revolutions in the Soviet Union, Vietnam, and Cuba, to name a few, threatened to undo the very notion of private property. And while U.S. and Western backlash nearly eliminated the socialist bloc in 1991, the imperialist order entered a transition stage of its own that some call neoliberalism. Neoliberalism has greatly expanded the reach of capitalism's tentacles and widened the impact of capitalist crisis since its inception in the late 1970s. Neoliberalism has unleashed unfettered capitalist production by imposing economic stagnation on participating countries. Meanwhile, China's socialist model has paved a different path, one marked by unprecedented growth and poverty reduction. China has understandably attracted underdeveloped nations so desperately seeking to escape the neocolonial impoverishment of the U.S. and West. Russia has grown close to China, providing both countries with much-needed assistance in the way of constructing a multipolar economic arrangement based on the principles of sovereignty and mutually beneficial cooperation. According to the logic of neoliberal capital, only war with Russia and China can save the system from itself. This conclusion stems from the fact that neoliberal capital is not growing, it is contracting. 80% of workers are near poor in the U.S., while 6 mega billionaires hold ownership over half of the planet's wealth. Concentrated profit does not mean that all is well with the ruling class. Internal contradictions are eating the capitalist system alive. Neither finance capital nor its monopoly investors can arrest the resultant decline. The growth of technology to speed up production and profit has left millions in permanent unemployment. A high-tech system of production is an expensive system of production, requiring lower wages and debt to absorb the falling rate of profit. Global overproduction has thus developed alongside mass misery. Such conditions are the root of mass incarceration, where millions of mostly black and poor workers are warehoused in cages because there's nothing on the outside that the system can offer. They are also at the root of mass surveillance, as a system must keep tabs on an increasingly restless population and justify infringements on civil liberties as necessary counter-terror measures. The war on terror and drugs have been prerequisites toward keeping the population scared and its attention away from the U.S. capitalist overlords who fund and support drug trafficking and terrorism for political gain. And when all else fails, blame Russia. The struggle against neoliberal capital and anti-Russia hysteria is a struggle to transform and revolutionize society. This struggle requires both political organization and ideological development. There will be no revolution without revolutionary thought, and no revolution without revolutionary action. All too often, the left is debating which one is the most important for the future success of a revolutionary movement. The answer is both, together. For most, this explanation is understandably too broad to inform individual political energy. Liberal thought and action thus becomes attractive because it hides behind the cloak of the possible and pragmatic. It is easier to think in terms of electoral politics than in global struggle. It is far more simple to advocate for a cooperative economy or universal basic income without spelling out the context that prevents their formation. In order for any material victories to be won on a mass scale in this period, the victors must understand the world in which they fight. Conscious struggle has brought about deep and meaningful changes in recent years. Mumia Abu-Jamal is now receiving Hep C treatment after years of struggle with the state of Pennsylvania. The release of Chelsea Manning and Oscar Rivera Lopez also comes to mind. Solidarity with Cuba freed the Cuban Five and has given the socialist nation more opportunities to develop its economy. But these victories have come in the midst of great costs. A movement for social transformation in the U.S. is still yet to be born, as the presence of dozens of political prisoners and the ongoing U.S. blockade against Cuba reminds us. Not once did I mention the Democratic or Republican parties. Both parties have done their part to create the crisis before us. A rejection of the two parties means an embrace of the struggle against imperialism worldwide. It means that the nations with U.S. targets on their backs should be seen as potential allies. Yes, this includes Russia and Syria. It includes the left movements in Latin America. In the spirit of Malcolm X, the Black Liberation Movement, and the historic anti-imperialist struggle around the globe, the time has come to search for real bonds of solidarity around the world to aid in the struggle against white supremacy, capitalism, and empire in the U.S. and West. Let no one, not even those who call themselves the left, tell you otherwise.
Daoud Andres is a Haitian activist, and he works with Kamakota.
I'm very happy to see so many folks packed into this room for this session, Resisting Trump, Exposing the Democrats. And like for many of our people, we say, well, what's the difference between Trump and the Democrats? Because from the perspective of our country, from the time we became an independent country, we have been equally attacked by Democrats and Republicans. And sometimes it's very difficult for us to understand the notion of progressive Americans in the context that, you know, when the bombs are dropping, what do you do? What do you say? Where is it coming from? And the word solidarity popped up many times, but for me, it's beyond solidarity, the way we have to understand the work that has to be done, the struggle that has to be waged against this entire thing, everything I say that we see here in the government, in the corporations, in the what's called the system that oppresses not just people over here, but all over the world. We have to look that it's one struggle, whether it's people that are in Haiti, in Africa, in the Middle East, Asia, and also over here, people who feel that this cannot continue. The brother Raymond Nat Turner, who started the program with beautiful poetry for us, carries the name Nat Turner. But Nat Turner, this rebellion, this uprising that happened, attempt, we believe, at revolution, just the same revolution that happened in Haiti. I don't know how many of you know that this happened exactly 40 years after the very day that our people in Haiti launched the Haitian Revolution. So if people, our family back then, understood this kind of connection and acted on it, I think today we have so much more access to information and to capacity to act in unison with people struggling all over the world to do the same. I have to say greetings to Brother Ralph Pointer and Sister Betty in the back. Every Tuesday they do a radio program and Brother Turner, being Nat Turner, starts the program with poetry such as you heard today. And it's geared towards liberation of political prisoners. I mean, I don't know how many people in this room are connected to the struggle to free not just Mubia, not just, you know, the high-profile ones, Oscar Lopez Rivera, but all of these political prisoners in the jails, people who are there for doing what many of us did not have or do not have today the courage to do. Yeah, I think that's very important. One of the reasons I think that we were invited here, I'm a member of a group called Comocoda. It's the Committee to Mobilize Against Dictatorship in Haiti. And we connect dictatorship in Haiti to what's going on over here. Because we haven't had a dictator in Haiti that was not being supported by people over here. This is our reality. When we started in 2014, we launched our movement. And we didn't know who was going to be against Clinton, but we knew Clinton was going to go to be president. And we said, you know, whatever it takes to stop this family from getting back to the White House over here, let it happen. To connect that to what I was saying before, because for us, it's not about salvaging this system. It's not about making it better. It's not about, like, because I'm sitting here next to my brother, right? And I'm thinking, how many people, if he was the vice president now, right? How many, who here would be working in the Pentagon? at CIA, you know? I mean, I don't know, but what would you be doing in the Pentagon? Making the world better?
Demolition work.
So for us, people who understand that this government, this system needs to come down, needs to be destroyed for the world to live. It's not about, like, you know, voting someone who's not so bad, you know, who's going to do a little bit. But to understand that it has to be taken down for the world to live. This is the reality. This is the reality. And Black Agenda has done so much exposing the Democrats, you know. By the way, we said to vote for Trump, and we knew he was going to win, Margaret, because we understood that however bad that all of you can see that Trump is bad, for many of us, many people around the world, the Clintons have done more harm to us. And they went to the heart of our people, because our country, it's, people call it the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. We don't really know what that means. Because when we look at the United States, we say, this is rich. Like, what do you have in terms of humanity? Like, who could, like, look at what this country is doing around the world and go on with your life? So I think people have to reimagine the concept of who is rich, who is poor, what is rich, what is poor. So I would really love for you guys to take that notion very seriously and think about that when you see people around the world do things to people you might feel are innocent people. You see, really take that to heart, because every mother cries for their children, you see, and we all bleed the same wherever we are. And if you kill my son today, what is the Gil Scott Heron, watch your back, mother. Because if I don't come today, I will come tomorrow. And if I cannot, my brother will, my sister will, somebody will. Right? Right now, we are involved in this thing with the Black misleaders who have decided that Hillary Clinton should be the keynote speaker for the graduation of our kids at Medgar Evers College. Yeah. So this is happening next Saturday, the 8th, at the Barclays Center, 9 a.m. My son is graduating there, along with the children of other members of our organization. But we started protesting at Medgar Evers last month, and the students, the staff, many of them didn't even know that this was the decision that Rudy Crewe, if you don't know, is the president, Giuliani's old water boy. Yeah. And he, if you can imagine that when we started protesting there, and a lot of the students joined with us, and they were mobilizing inside the school. And what does the school do? They announce that Medgar Evers' wife, who's now 84 years old, will be the one introducing Hillary Clinton on Saturday. You see? And we understand when, and this is what I think Black Agenda means when they speak the Black misleadership class. You have Monica Lewinsky business, and Jesse Jackson goes to the White House to pray with Bill Clinton. The kids, what they understand is that someone who referred to them as dogs, who need to be brought to heel, this is the person that is being brought to give this commencement speech, and that the school is honoring with a doctorate on that day. So we don't need to go about the billions they stole in Haiti. We hope all of you know this. They didn't go to help Haiti. The minimum wage sweatshops, they stole money, billions of dollars. And you might laugh, but people in Haiti, we believe that the millions that were spent for their daughter's wedding came from earthquake relief money. You see? This is what America represents to us. They are not anomalies, the Clintons. The Trumps of the world, they are not anomalies. When people around the world that are being oppressed, that are under the gun, we imagine America, we see America. I'll tell you guys a joke, like when the earthquake happens, people who had a U.S. passport, they ran however they could to get to the airport. And I have a sister, who was in Haiti, born in Haiti, but has a U.S. passport, was there with a Black American brother. And they rushed to the airport. And when they got there, they went to the American line. Well, the staff is like, hell no, Americans, Americans. There is reality and there is perception. And I think that you guys have to, it's not that the people in this room are too small a group to wage a real fight to make the reality that the world understands of people over here something else. Because you have to understand that right now, people see Trump as America. People see the Clintons as America. Not people who are trying to do something a little better. And I think this is a mission that would be good for this group to take on. Thank you.
Glenn Ford spent many, many years in the media, former Washington Bureau, White House, Capitol Hill reporter for various different outlets. He then launched the Black World Report and the Black Agenda Report, and he's currently the executive director of the latter. Glenn Ford.
Power to the people. I always say power to the people, and it's not because I have nostalgia for a movement of the previous era. I say that to keep myself focused on the mission. And the mission is the transformation of society, and you accomplished that mission by defeating those forces that disempower the people and that threaten our species with extinction. This evening, our job is to discuss the rise of movements that challenge repressive institutions and discourses. Any kind of discussion like that has to talk about who is the enemy and what is the enemy up to and what are the people's forces doing about that enemy and his shenanigans. Who are the allies and who are the potential allies of the people? And we have to decide what forces can usefully be called part of the people's movement. Is there broad agreement among the various sectors of what people are calling a people's movement? Is there broad agreement on principles? Or instead, is there a general state of confusion? The Left Forum is the biggest gathering of its kind of leftists in the United States. And so we're obligated, I think especially since it's a yearly affair, to talk about what happened over the past year that may have made a real profound change in the state of the movement. This past year has seen huge developments. These have been history-shaking events, and I think history will tell us that. Events that have had a very deep impact on the political landscape and an impact on the prospects of defeating the main enemy of humanity. And of course, that main enemy is U.S. imperialism in its global and its domestic manifestations. And those global and domestic manifestations are not just interrelated, they are inextricable. You cannot separate them. I believe that the most far-reaching development in the past year has been the destabilization of the duopoly political system in the United States, and that that has resulted in the Democratic Party becoming, and I'm stealing somebody else's quote here, the Democrats becoming the truly explicit party of the ruling class in the United States. And as such an explicitly ruling class party, the Democratic Party has definitively become the most aggressive war party. This definitive war party coalesced. We actually saw it come together this past election season. And it came together in that big nasty tent that Hillary Clinton used as a headquarters in her campaign. Trump disrupted, or at least temporarily defeated, the Republican Party's establishment. But that's not what really upset and put into a panic the ruling class. He also assembled a mass movement, and that mass movement was brought together based on what seemed to be his promise to create an even more virulently white racist white man's party than the Republican Party has been since at least 1964 with Barry Goldwater's campaign, and certainly since 1968 with Richard Nixon. However, virulent racism in the Republican Party has not upset the ruling class. It has not driven them mad. It has not led to a destabilization of the duopoly. The ruling class has been quite fine with having one party whose principle in terms of organizing the masses is white supremacy, and having another one in which the other folks are in. And it funds both of them. So that's not what destabilized the U.S. duopoly system. What destabilized the system was when Mr. Trump, rhetorically at least, made noises about lessening tensions with Russia and ending U.S. Regime change policies. And he also made noises about doing something about the free flow of money and jobs to foreign destinations, which seemed to ruling class ears to link him in some kind of alignment with the insurgency that was going on in the Democratic Party with Bernie Sanders. It was Donald Trump's lack of trustworthiness, however, on foreign policy that was really key to the panic that set in among the ruling class. And when I say the ruling class, I mean as represented in the establishment Republican Party as well as in the Democratic Party. Donald Trump was not seen as being trustworthy on the issue of continuing U.S. war policies, and that made him into anathema for the bulk of the ruling class. And especially it made him anathema to the spooks and the spies and the assassins and the regime changers of the intelligence services, but also to those people who these spooks and spies and assassins work, whose missions these assassins are carrying out. The profoundness of the shift that occurred, this flocking of the ruling class into Hillary Clinton's tent, can be seen, I think, best with the way the corporate media behave. The corporate media does not have an independent existence in the United States. It is not some other estate out there that somehow functions based upon its own compass. It is owned by finance capital, and it operates as the voice of the ruling class. The ruling class uses the corporate media to argue out its differences. The people have to have alternative media in order to have a righteous conversation about what they would like to happen in society. And so when we see, as we saw, this unprecedented shift of basically the totality of the corporate media into Hillary Clinton's camp, into the Democratic camp, and their almost universal opposition to Donald Trump, that was the most visible indication that the ruling class was upset about Donald Trump. And what were they upset about? I said before, it was not his racism. That's been fine with the ruling class. It was his position, or what they thought was his position, or their anxiety about what his position might be on the continuation of the war policies. And we're talking about the war policies that date from 2011 with Barack Obama. Barack Obama's mission was to rebuild not just the U.S. image in the world, and he did that with his face and his charm, but actually to reposition the U.S. military to once again try to seize control of this whole energy-rich region, not just Iran, not just Syria, but to project U.S. power deep into Central Asia, and with the aim of establishing U.S. control over that area so that in a future confrontation, an inevitable confrontation with China, the rising economic power, the United States would be able to strangle or threaten to strangle China, to threaten to deny it access to that part of the world, and thereby maintain, continue U.S. dominance even as U.S. economic power and other power shrinks. So this is what George Bush was up to in 2003, and he failed. He was defeated. Barack Obama's mission was to try it again, and that's what was set in motion in 2011. And it has to be understood that for the ruling class, and they spend millions and millions of dollars funding think tanks, and they have access to supercomputers, and they're not, even if they're stupid, they hire people who are not. And they see the handwriting on the wall, and they know what time that clock is ticking towards. And so they see this battle, this military mission that they're on in what we in general call the Middle East, as being part of an existential struggle. They believe that if they do not put this stranglehold on this part of the world and somehow put themselves in a position to coerce themselves into a continued dominance, that they are through, and they are probably right. And that is what propels them into war. And this feeling that they are in an existential struggle is what caused the panic and this alignment after the destabilization of the Republican Party that has created this maelstrom, this Niagara Falls of the Russians are somehow destabilizing us. It is basically simply a war cry. That's what this is about. And you are making a fundamental misreading of events if you believe that this "the Russians did it" mania has something to do just with jockeying position for the Democratic Party to gain some kind of advantage. Of course, the Democratic Party wants to gain advantage. All parties do. But that's not what the ruling class is upset about. The ruling class is intent that its United States military offensive keeps moving on. And here's something that really shocked them during Trump's campaign. When he said those words that so upset the ruling class, that, you know, we shouldn't do so much regime change, maybe we can get along with Russia, it was expected that his constituency, his base, what we usually call Middle America, which is a euphemism for white folks out there, that this group of people was the bulwark of the American pro-war party, or at least the party that could always be whipped up into a war frenzy at the drop of a hat. The people out there who have "nuke 'em" and just fill in the blanks as their bumper sticker. So when Donald Trump addressing exactly that cohort of people, when they did not bat an eye, when he was talking about what sounded like peaceful coexistence, and they didn't bat an eye when he was talking about stopping all this overthrowing of people for no reason, that really scared the hell out of the ruling class, and especially the national security establishment. Because if Trump's people were not wedded to war at the drop of the hat, then where is the constituency for war? And this told them a lesson, that if they wanted to keep the country at war fever, they were going to have to work at it. They were going to have to gin this up every day. They couldn't just rely upon the middle Americans that they had relied on to somehow just be ready to jump into regime change and war with Russia anytime they gave a dog whistle. They had to work at it. And now I think we can understand where this "the Russians are colluding with Trump and trying to wreck our democracy" and this unprecedented screaming noise every day, every hour about the Russians. You know, I'm 67 years old. I remember a piece of the McCarthy era. I remember the House Un-American Activities Committee. I remember the TV show I Led Three Lives, which was about nefarious secret communists doing all kinds of daring things. There was never anything like the decibel level, the frequency, the insanity, the madness of this anti-Russian campaign that we hear right now. This is a sign of a ruling class in panic. And I guess we're supposed to be, if we really are good leftists, we're supposed to be happy because the ruling class is in panic. They acting like the fool. But panicky people with nuclear weapons and the biggest prison system in the world and all of the gadgets that they have can do some very dangerous things. So one can feel good that the rulers are disintegrating mentally, but become very scared about what that mentally deficient person might do. So we have to understand that this anti-Russian campaign is a war cry. So who's picking up the chorus on this? One of the reasons that it's so dangerous is that people who would be thought of in previous times as allies of the movement, and I think that would include folks like Maxine Waters, for example, not necessarily part of the movement, but someone who could be called upon in previous eras to be maybe of some use. And yet here we have a Maxine Waters who believes now everything that the CIA and the NSA say, and forgot that she herself, back in the 90s, charged that the CIA was responsible for bringing crack into LA. She's forgotten this entirely because she's singing this war song about the Russians. The whole Congressional Black Caucus has joined in this anti-Russian chorus, and we have to understand it as a pro-war chorus that is singing a war song. And for their kind of resistance, the Democratic Party's kind of resistance, the anti-Russian theme is a song of resistance. So we have to understand when they get excited at what they believe is an anthem is actually a call to war. And this presents us with real problems. It addresses that question that I raised early on. Who are the allies and potential allies of the people, and what forces can usefully be called part of the people's movement? What forces can usefully be called part of the real resistance? If you are resisting Russian collusion with Trump, then what you are resisting is a fantasy. And if you are simply resisting Trump, the idiot in the White House, then you are simply a tool of a Democratic Party strategy. And that strategy is to gain advantage. When I say that the Democrats are now the driving engine of war, that means they are the driving engine of U.S. imperialism. And I'm also saying that they have nothing else to offer but war and imperialism. And even more so now that they have definitively become the party of the ruling class. War is not something that real movement folks should oppose just on principle because they don't like the idea of other people being killed. It's a matter of self-preservation. When the imperialists go to war and invest in war, they create corresponding structures of repression at home for those who might resist war. But when they decide that they are going to absorb all the public and private wealth of the home country, just as they have been doing with other countries all over the world with all their centuries of imperialism, then they must put another layer of repression on the existing mechanisms. So we should not see our opposition to war as just some kind of favor that we are doing to the people who are victimized by the U.S. war machine. The U.S. war machine requires that there be a corresponding repression of us here at home. That's the kind of function of the U.S. war machine that Maxine Waters has forgotten. So I think that I've taken up much more time than I've been allotted. But I also hope that it's clear that one of the things that I'm saying is that we need a rejuvenated anti-war movement in this country. And all of our movement politics must be an anti-war politics, or else we are defenseless against this kind of strategy on the part of the Democrats, who pretend that they are somehow an alternative to the fascist-sounding and definitely virulently white nationalist forces in the Republican Party, but are themselves intent on a war policy that can mean the extinction of the entire human race. So I want to give a salute before I leave to Ajamu Baraka. Ajamu Baraka is not only the former vice presidential candidate of the Green Party, but he's also an editor of Black Agenda Report. And his campaign currently is to pull together a black alliance for peace so that there is an explicitly black anti-war mechanism. Black folks Most people don't remember that SNCC and other early civil rights organizations were opposed to U.S. imperialism and the then not so big Vietnam War before there was a large anti-war movement, and that Julian Bond was ejected from the Georgia legislature because of his resistance to the war and to the draft. And we have to resume that position as the foremost opponents of war in this whole spectrum of movement that we're building today. And so I salute Ajamu for bringing us back to where we need to be in the future. Power to the people.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network. We'll be right back.